Good evening, everyone. And yesterday, someone said that many people who come on Thursdays don't know who I am. And last time I was here on Thursday, I didn't introduce myself, so I thought probably I should introduce myself. And I'm Gil Fronsdahl, and I've been teaching meditation here on the peninsula and for this group for about 12 years. And mostly I teach for the Sunday and Monday classes that we have. Can you hear me okay, everyone? Okay, up there? And what's been on my mind for some time is the topic of desire. And probably all of Buddhism can be considered a meditation on desire. It's all about understanding our desires. And even though Buddhism has sophisticated philosophy and beliefs and faiths and all kinds of range of practices, it could probably, with justice, be reduced to a study on the issue of desire. I believe that probably everything you need to understand about liberation, about Buddhism, about the spiritual path that the Buddha had to offer can be understood by investigating, understanding really well our desires. And so I want to kind of just talk on the topic for a while, and my own meditation on the topic. And I want to start with a story, of when I was younger, in my teens and early 20s, I used to read a lot. And I'd be absorbed in books, and it's hard to sometimes get my attention because I was reading all the time. And I enjoyed a lot walking into bookstores. And but I found that when I left bookstores, I felt awful. I felt kind of... going into the bookstores, I felt this, this joy of anticipation of what I might find there, and the desire to find another great book and interesting topics to explore. And when I left, I'd often feel drained and feel exhausted and tense and maybe a little bit headachy, kind of frazzled. So I paid some attention to this, and I realized the reason for this was that I would go into bookstores and I would have a desire feast. Desires would just take over because there's all these books that I wanted. And there's a lot of individual books in the bookstore, so you can go through and just... Well, that's a good one. I want that. And I usually wouldn't buy a book because, for various reasons, including I didn't have any money when I was young. So the idea of buying a book was kind of, I'd rather go to the library or something. But I would just see all these titles and I'd look at the title page or whatever and I want that. And the accumulation of all those kind of constant desire and clinging and wanting was exhausting for me. And I leave the bookstore exhausted. That little story is, in a sense, a little kind of nutshell of what the Buddha had to say about not necessarily desire, but a certain kind of desire. A kind of desire that is characterized by having some element of grasping as part of it that is exhausting and that brings a lot of suffering into our lives. And in fact, the Buddha emphasized that the cause of suffering, the cause of our individual suffering, the suffering we can do something about, the suffering that the practice is really trying to address, not all pains about being a human being, but the suffering that we can take some responsibility for, is that suffering that arises because of our grasping. The word that he chose was not grasping, was the word thirst. And we use that word in English. It's the word in Indian language, tanha, which means thirst. And in English, we use that word, also sometimes, when someone has really strong desire, they're thirsting, thirsting for blood. Isn't that an expression? Yeah, that's the first one that came to my mind. You really want to fight, maybe, is that what it means? Like, just really eager for a fight. What does it mean? Thirsting for blood? A fight? Let's go in the alley. And so to say of thirsting, a certain kind of desire that kind of grips us and becomes very powerful, kind of passionate, or kind of like you imagine if you're really thirsty and parched, and you have kind of the desire that really goes into, I want this now. And the Buddhist suggestion is that kind of desire creates all of the suffering that is optional in human life. And so how do we kind of... Suddenly there was an echo. Do you hear it too? So are you okay with the sound? Maybe it's just me? It's echoing here, okay. So if you have trouble with the sound speaker, just raise your hand. So one of the interesting things to study is the cost of desire, of having desire, having grasping desire. And certainly there can be exhaustion, as happened to me in this little story of bookstores. But there's a lot of costs in pursuing desire at times, a grasping desire, a needy desire, craving. One of the interesting ones is it lends itself to always being externally focused, in the sense that you're always looking at an object that you want or you want changed. And it's innocent enough in itself, but for example, if I want this bell because it's a nice bell and makes a nice sound, I could have a very innocent desire. It'd be nice to have this at home, and end of my morning sittings I could ring it. That's an innocent desire. But if I grasp, you know, easy come, easy go, desires are a dime a dozen. And so it's easy for me, you know, to see them arise and pass away, usually. But sometimes, you know, like I'm gripped by a desire. Oh, that bell. I got to have that bell. It's so pleasant. It's so wonderful. It's so cool. And, you know, I bet my meditations at home would be really dynamite if I had this good meditation bell. And I wonder who I can talk to at the center to get it. I wonder, you know, maybe I can buy it. Maybe I could, you know, when no one's looking, I could swipe it. And maybe, you know, and the mind gets gripped by the desire. And the desire, in a sense, has gripped the mind. It's leading the mind around. The desire is fueling the mind's thoughts and concerns, and you're not in charge anymore. You've lost charge of your own mind. You've lost mastery of your own life when a desire is leading you around by the nose and all your thoughts and your ideas. So, but the interesting thing is when I want the bell, I'm focusing on something, on an object, the bell. What we could do in meditation practice or in any kind of mindfulness practice is train ourselves to turn the attention away from the object of what we want and instead feel the desiring. Feel what it's like to be a human being who has desire coursing through your body, your system. Now, when you're looking at the object and really want it, it's often sometimes the seduction of pleasure. It can be very pleasant sometimes to want. Though I know sometimes when it's very powerful, when desire is powerful enough, you can't even sleep at night, as I've had experiences, you know, right, tossing and turning because my passion was so strong for the woman next door in the other room, you know, she left the door open. What do I do? But focus is external, can often be external. And what happens when the focus is external is we lose touch with ourselves. And it might be innocent enough with one desire, but it's easy also instead to have many desires in a row and spend a day pursuing all kinds of desires. And in doing that, losing touch with who we are subjectively, what's really going on within us. And so training in mindfulness is not to reject desire, but rather to train ourselves to turn away from the object to really honestly feel what's going on in here. One of the things you'll find is the cost of having grasping desire. You actually feel the alienation from yourself sometimes, especially if it's chronic and regular. One of the interesting things that happens to people sometimes is that if you're on kind of a roll with a lot of desires, it might be kind of pleasant, the seduction, the fantasy of the desire, but it's unpleasant the kind of way in which we lose touch with ourselves. And people who are chronically in the desire mode are increasingly alienated from themselves, lost touch with themselves, which makes them feel uncomfortable, uneasy. And one of the reasons human beings grasp is to try to avoid feeling discomfort. We feel off in some way, so we want something to satisfy us. And so this wonderful paradox of the desiring, if it's a habit, it's a lot of we do all the time, alienates us from ourselves, which makes us feel bad, And feeling bad makes us want to desire more to make us feel better. The seduction of, it'll make me feel better. I saw this very dramatically when I had this health problem. I had a wheat allergy for about 7 years. And one of the characteristics sometimes of food allergies, apparently, it certainly was with me, was that you crave the food you're allergic to. So I would feel kind of, and I worked at a bakery. So I would crave, you know, sometimes I feel, you know, whatever reason, I'd maybe feel bad or whatever. I would eat some bread, and then I'd feel bad. So I wanted to kind of comfort myself. So my desire was, well, I want some comfort food, which was, I love baguettes. I worked at the Tassajara Bakery. It was great bread. And so I'd eat this wonderful French bread and baguettes and stuff, and then I'd feel worse. And then I'd want to comfort myself more, so I'd eat more bread. And I'd feel worse. And it would be this awful spiral. I didn't know what was happening yet. I didn't know what the cause of my allergy, what the problem was. I just knew I was feeling... I remember walking through San Francisco thinking I needed to be institutionalized because I couldn't even think. If someone asked me something, I don't think I would have been able to answer because I was just so numbed out by this allergy. So I mean, that's with food, but it can happen without food. You know, we kind of lose touch with ourselves. Also, there's the interesting thing about wanting is generally, I think more than generally, most of the time, when you want something, you're usually future-oriented. It might be a future in a second. It might be in a minute. It might be in a day. It might be in a year. But it's like I want something, and I want, you know, so we're focusing on how we're going to get it in the future. And as we do that, we lose touch with the present. And that's one of the costs of desiring. It's too easy to lose touch with not only ourselves, but just the present, hold the richness of the present moment. Another cost of desire is frustration. Is that if your desire isn't fulfilled, and you really have this neediness connected to your desire, and your desire is not fulfilled, you feel frustrated. And it could be worse than that. It could be angry or furious. And there's a cost of that. And it can be a setup for anger and frustration to be pursuing desire blindly, unrealistically. Another cost of desire is when we're in the grips of it too powerfully, we don't make sound judgments. We don't usually think, you know, we don't have wise decisions about what we want, what we need. I made, you know, many people have seen that with food, right? You see this wonderful food, you know, it's being served at your dinner or whatever, and you say, wow, you know, mashed potatoes. I love mashed potatoes. You know, it'd be really satisfying to have just another helping of those great mashed potatoes with butter on top. And you know, it actually is, you know, this desire and yearning, and it is actually pleasant to eat it until you just, ugh, you're so heavy, and, you know, you spend the next 2 hours saying, oh, why did I do that? Somehow, sometimes our best interest is not served by that part of the mind that's consumed by desire. We sometimes don't make wise decisions. Another cost of desire is sometimes, and this is Buddhist language, and the Buddha said, I think, or at least in Buddhist language, is it said that you can become ugly. I think what this means is that it's not pleasant to be around someone who just kind of want. I know my son is that way sometimes, and sometimes I just want to, you know, give me a break. You know, just, can I have this? Can I have that? Can I want that? This, that, this? I don't understand how anybody could have so many desires. Except sometimes I look at my own mind and then I say, oh, I'm just not vocal about it. And one of the interesting things with my little son is that when he was two, you know, he seems sometimes like a little desire machine, just wants stuff. And sometimes he could have desire without knowing what it was he wanted. So, for example, I held him once, and I walked into a room, I was holding him. He had no idea what was behind him. But he went like this to grab it. He really wanted it. Whatever was there, he wanted to have. You know, it's kind of like this, you know, wanting with a blank check, kind of unspecified wanting. Just, you knew, you know, it's wanting, the momentum of wanting. That's another cost of the wanting. If the wanting is chronic, the desiring is chronic, even if it's healthy desire, there can be healthy desires. If it's chronic, if it's regular, repetitive, over and over and over again, the mind gets into a rhythm, into momentum of wanting desire, of having doing that kind of activity of desiring. And so, say that every possible desire you have has been fulfilled, but the mind is still in that mode, and it's sort of looking for something to desire, because it just wants to fill that, you know, that need, that momentum, that activity of the mind, which has become habitual. And I see it myself sometimes when if I'm at home, and I'm doing a lot of activities at home, like cleaning and, you know, all the different chores at home, and I'm trying to get through it quickly and doing a lot, especially if you do it quickly, not do it mindfully. There's a kind of subtle desire that goes into wanting to clean, wanting to finish, wanting to do this, and then. And I'll finally stop, and I might sit down on the couch or something, and there's this momentum still within me. Sometimes it's hard to stop. I'm doing home improvement these days, you know, and trying to actually doing some little sheetrocking and stuff in my basement. And I get so in this mode of wanting to do things, sometimes it's hard for me to want to stop because I'm just kind of driven by, you know, by the activity. When I was in my early 20s, I was hitchhiking. And I was picked up by this little older man. I was traveling, you know, it was a long hitchhiking trip. And so we started talking about our lives. And I started telling him the things I wanted to do with my life. And, you know, I wanted to study Zen, Buddhism, and I wanted to study Sufism, and I wanted to study Aikido, and I wanted to study Rolfing, and I wanted to study Gestalt, and I wanted to study organic farming, and I wanted to learn carpentry, and I wanted to, you know, and it was going through a litany of the things that I wanted to do. And at some point, the man turned to me and said, "You have a lot of desires, don't you?" And, you know, that kind of caught my attention. It kind of like woke me up and realized, you know, probably I didn't have enough years in my life to fulfill all those desires. And so that, I kind of started paying attention a little bit more to my desires then. And some years later, reflecting back at this, telling him all the things that I wanted to do with my life, I realized that there was a desire in the conversation that I hadn't realized at the time. And that was, as I wanted to somehow impress him. I wanted to somehow create an impression for him making an identity for myself through what I wanted. I was like, I'm really cool because I want to do Zen Buddhism, right? And you should know that's what I want. I didn't know anything about Zen Buddhism, you know, but I wanted to know about it. And that made me cool, right? Put me in the right camp, whatever, you know, and I wanted him to kind of admire me a little bit. And so I had to do my self-identity, myself, you know, I was trying to paint a picture of who I was. So there was this wanting to be a certain person in the eyes of this other person. Do you understand this? Is this something you're familiar with at all? So I had these other desires, but I was using those desires to fulfill this more fundamental desire of self-identity, of being someone. Why was that desire there? Sometimes it can be there because of fear. We're afraid of being judged. One of my issues when I was younger was I really wanted people to like me. The fear, you know, the reverse was I was a fear of people not liking me. And I was, you know, driven by this trying to make people like me. And until I just got exhausted from the effort and realized that this just wasn't worth it, because why should every human being have to like me? I mean, is it okay to have some people not like me? I mean, why should I, you know, sacrifice my whole life trying to manipulate, negotiate, and kind of create a certain persona so that everyone likes me rather than just be myself? It turns out people like me more when I'm myself than I am when I'm trying to get them to like me. But so that, you know, that was partly what's going on. Partly it can be the desire for security, or the fear, you know, the fear that's connected to that. These can be very fundamental, kind of existential desires that we feel driven by, and sometimes we don't see it. They're operating on kind of subtle level, Like, for example, they're telling this pick guy picked me up, you know, all my desires, what I wanted to do with my life. It took many years to see the underlying desire of trying to be a certain kind of person. And there's a cost, even when you can't see it. It's kind of subconscious in a sense. It might take a while to see it. It can have a tremendous cost on the psyche. It can be exhausting and tiring, put a lot of stress on the system, on you. It can cause all the things I talked about, the alienation. And the alienation is very interesting because that's more subtle kind of desiring comes from a deeper part within us, which is that deeper part within us is the place where if we're going to really feel at home in this world or with ourselves, we have to somehow access that deep place, which oddly enough is also the place that feels vulnerable and feels this insecurity and all these kinds of issues. So we have to learn to bring our attention back and really see and be honest about these things. Very, very honest. Not because it's moralistic and you're good or bad because of it, but because that's kind of the access point, the entry point to some of the deeper, you know, areas of freedom within our psyche and well-being and happiness and love and compassion. Our desires operate so subtly. I was coming over here this evening and I was thinking I'll talk about desire. And I got in my car and I didn't even notice that I had the desire to turn the radio until I was reaching over to turn it on. There had to be a desire there first, right? And I didn't catch that desire. All I knew, I was reaching over to turn on the radio. Is that subtle, right? I mean, that level. But it's more subtle. It's as subtle as there's desires operating in the thoughts that you pursue. That, you know, your thinking is manipulated by your desires. And desires operate in what we pursue in the thinking world. Oh, my wants. I want to pursue that thought. That's a pleasant thought. That's a self-aggrandizing thought. I think I'll go with that. Lots of meditators who sometimes on retreat who struggle for a couple of days on retreat, and then they'll come to interview and say, they'll say, I struggled, but then I had this really great fantasy. And I just went with it because I felt like I needed a vacation or I deserved it or, you know, whatever. You know, they kind of off they go because it's, you know, it takes them away from their own deep process of what's going on. And it's fascinating in meditation in particular, if the mind gets a little bit quiet, to begin tracking how desires operate in the mind itself. You know, in the subtlety, in the thoughts, in the stream of what we think about and what we pick up. And there's a saying in Buddhism, a very graphic saying, that grasping, or this kind of grasping desire, is like licking the honey off the edge of a razor. Honey is really sweet and wonderful, right? But so there's this double-edged thing that can be with grasping desire. Pursue this wonderful thing, but there's a cost. So part of what mindfulness practice helps us do is to understand the cost of having a desire, of desiring. But maybe I need to back up a little bit, because someone will probably ask, all desires bad? Is all desires harmful? Or all desires have a cost like this? And that's not the case. The word desire is kind of, in Buddhism, there's a word, like for example, chanda in Pali. In Buddhism, we can take desire to be a neutral word. It's kind of an umbrella word. And within the word desire is an umbrella word that covers a wide spectrum of different kind of motivations that go from one end of the extreme, become addiction or craving or grasping or thirsting or compulsion or drivenness or what are some other juicy words like that? Some people would put passion there, but that's a problematic because we have some wide range of what we mean by passion. And then on the other end of this spectrum are things like aspiration and wish and inclination of the mind. There can be wholesome desire. And there can be helpful desire, desire that doesn't cause us more suffering, and there's desires that do cause us more suffering. And part of what mindfulness practice is helping us do is to separate out those desires which are useful and helpful and appropriate from those which are tinged or overwhelmed by this grasping, the contraction and tightening of neediness of grasping. So, you know, many of us, as I said, desires are a dime a dozen. Some desires are quite innocent, you know, relatively. You want to go to the bathroom, there's a desire to find the toilet. Maybe that's more like thirsting, so if you're really desperate, but you know, there's nothing wrong with wanting to find a bathroom. Nothing wrong to want to eat if you're hungry. Nothing wrong to say a nice word to a friend who's having a hard day. There's a lot of beautiful things. Compassion is a really beautiful aspect of the human heart. And compassion is expressed in a particular kind of desire, the desire for someone else's welfare. So to differentiate between those, that suffering, that desire which is suffering producing and that which is not is very important. And then to be wise about that desire which is suffering producing. In order to make that distinction, again, mindfulness is very helpful. In particular, it's very helpful to practice mindfulness of the body. To pay attention to what is going on in your body when you have a desire. If it's a helpful, wholesome desire, you probably feel very differently in your body than if it's an unhelpful one, which is suffering-produced one. Because on one hand, you'll feel a suffering. You feel the contraction, the tightness. You feel the gnawing. You feel the yearning. You'll feel the compulsion, the demand. Sometimes desires can have tremendous authority in our minds. A very powerful sense of compulsion. It has to be right now. If you try not to follow through on the desire, you feel the suffering there. You feel the tension, the angst, the whatever, all those feelings there. In traditional Buddhist monastic training, they use this, in a sense, they use frustration as a tool to help us understand ourselves. If you have free rein to shop until you drop, to just do whatever you want, to follow all your desires, you're not so likely to understand what's really going on when you're desiring. But if you're not allowed to desire, if you're not allowed to fulfill your desires and act on them, then it kind of comes right up to your face. And you think, oh, gee, you know. And then you have to grapple sometimes with the passion and the craving and the compulsion. And really, you know, sometimes you can feel, you know, struggle at biblical proportions dealing with it. But the reason for that struggle is to find a level of self-mastery, self-compassion, self-control, and be able to enter into that depth of our being, which is not accessible when we're on the surface of life, which is often where these grasping desires reside. So what are the really great things to do? And this is a practice I've recommended many times. Is a practice called writing out a desire. Find yourself a really good desire. Don't find it, but wait until it finds you. Wait until you have some really strong thing that you really want, your really compulsion. And the greater the compulsion, the greater the addiction, the better. You know, but I guess you shouldn't go looking for it. But wait until it comes. You know, but when it comes, be ready. You know, the passion. You know, the desire to smoke or to drink or to, you know, something that just you got to do, or you're going to die. And when you feel that there, sit still. Go find a chair. Go find your cushion and meditate or something. And just go sit really still, be really still, and don't act on it. And instead, feel what's going on inside. Feel the physical sensations, the restlessness, the power of what's going on with this desire, the sense of compulsion, the inner voices, maybe the lawyers come, all your lawyers come, you know, come out. Have you noticed this? I've noticed this. I have desires sometimes, and it's accompanied by a team of lawyers, that is trying to explain, why this is, why this particular desire is ethical. You know, I know it's not ethical, you know, normally, but the lawyers explain, well, you know, if it's done this way and this way, you know. What?
The loophole,
yeah. And you have to be very careful with lawyers. But the great thing about the lawyers when they come along is you always have the veto power. So you don't have to worry too much about them. You just have to remember your veto power. But to write out the desire, Don't give in. And you might feel like you're going to die. You might start sweating, some people, you know, if it's really powerful addiction. Just like, and it might get build and build and build, and you're like, you might ready to scream. But you're committed to not moving, to not acting on it. Just, it's like riding the rodeo, except from the outside you look like you're completely still, but on the inside you feel like you're on a wild horse, right? And then sooner or later, that desire will weaken and pass away. It's like this wave breaks sometimes, and then it passes. And when it passes, you learn that you can ride it out. You learn that you have the ability not to listen to the authority of this desire. You learn that you are not the desire. You survived the desire. You didn't die with the passing of the desire. And I've heard people say they feel very empowered by doing this practice of riding out a desire. And then in the future it becomes easier because they know, oh, there'll be an end to it. I just have to hold on to the reins and it'll, you know, pass the time. And, you know, so maybe some desires maybe not that powerful that you feel like it's a rodeo. But, you know, probably find something. I remember once, this comes to mind now. I visited Abhayagiri Monastery. It's a Buddhist monastery up in Ukiah. And the tradition in the Buddhist monastery is that when you come to the monastery, you bring an offering of food for the monastic people living there. And I went with a group of friends. And everybody brought food, like for the lunch. Like it was a potluck, right? So it's like a potluck because the monks don't bring anything. They just eat. And so you offer this food. So I was so everybody, you know, it's a long drive up there, and all my friends brought some fresh food, or food that was just been cooked or something, and I really wanted to bring some food too to these monks, and it was a winter time, I think, and I knew that they don't have a lot of visitors in the winter time, and they're kind of dependent on people giving them food so they can eat. So I wanted to, you know, give them a supply of food to last, you know. When we weren't there, you know, after the weekend, during the week. And so I brought dry goods, beans and rice and spaghetti and things like that. Things that weren't ready to eat that particular morning when we were eating our lunch. So, you know, I made my offering to the kitchen. And then we went then to, I sat in the dining area where we were going to start this ritual of eating the food that had been brought for the day. And I had no idea the custom that they were about to start. And the custom was, they would bring out from the kitchen each plate, each dish that someone had brought, and they announced who brought it. And I got the gist very quickly that all my friends were going to be named, but I wasn't. And the monks and nuns there, they didn't know who had offered food. I mean, it wasn't like you offered, put it in their hands. You just took it to the kitchen, to the people who worked in the kitchen who were not monastics. So I said, oh, you know, I'm going to look really cheap or thoughtless, you know, and you know, I didn't bring anything for them, and, you know, they're getting all this credit, and, oh, whoa, it's me, you know, and, you know, this is terrible, and my self-identity and my self-worth and my friends, and, you know. And I had this compulsion in me to kind of say, raise my hands up, but I brought food too, just for another day. So, but I wrote out the desire. I saw it and I thought about it. This is ridiculous, you know, and to be caught up in my self-image like this. And I know that my best intention was to offer them food and help them out, and I don't have to get credit for that. I just know that they're going to be fed. I'll be happy. They don't have to know that I was the one who brought it. And so, you know, I talked myself, you know, calmed myself down. But desire, huh? So I imagine that this is, you know, a little bit familiar to some of you. Human beings we shouldn't be called human beings, we should be called human desirelings. And because it's such a, you know, pervasive aspect in human life. So what do you think of that? Do you have any questions or comments? Your own desire stories? Yes?
I had a question about the story you told about your son. Wanting all the time, and I have that. My kids do the same thing. Do you start now telling them something?
I'm trying to figure out what the wise thing is to do. My son is four, and so the last this morning today, it happened just a little while ago, and he said, you know, I want. Can I have that? He said, and he kept saying, can I have that? And I wasn't first. I didn't answer it, you know. And then I said to him, you have a lot of desires today. And he said, yeah, I know, I'm not going to have it. And so what I was trying to do was very matter-of-factly, without putting too much of a weight on it, just kind of mirroring back what he was doing so he could see. And I've done that in the past, and that's him sometimes has helped. But he sees what's going on, because sometimes it's hard for the child to be mindful themselves of what's happening. And so kind of very, hopefully without any judgment or with a lot of acceptance, just, oh. And I heard of a mother who, was going down the supermarket aisle with a child in the cart. And the child was, I want that, or reaching out to grab, you know. And you have to know how to do the cart right in the middle of the aisle so it's just out of the reach, right? I want that. And the mother was matter-of-factly naming each product. Oh, that's spaghetti, and that's... She was naming it. And so it's a way of kind of... It's a way of meeting the... Hopefully, a way of meeting the child, recognizing what the child was doing. Not giving into it, but also somehow meeting the child there in a way that is respectful. I've done that sometimes. I've tried to talk to him about, you know, why do you have all these desires? And he says, I don't know. And sometimes I've been quite firm and said, you know, absolutely not. You can't have that. That's enough now. And sometimes we've, you know, said, you know, I explained to him beforehand, you know, we're going into a store, we're going into a situation, and he starts asking for things. And I say, well, you know, you can have one thing. And, you know, you seem to want all these different things here. You can take one of them home, and you have to choose. And so he understands, he has one, you know, that's the deal. And he goes, and sometimes he'll take one thing, and he says, oh, I guess I don't want that, I want this one. And that gives him, you know, I like that because it starts giving him some sense of being able to choose among his desires. He doesn't have to fulfill all of them. And the other thing that I've done is sometimes when there's a lot of desire going on, just, you know, kind of just, try, you know, just seems crazy. I recognize that probably there's some other need he has. It isn't that he needs to have those things. He needs something else. Maybe he needs love. He needs contact. He needs attention. And so then I'll just, you know, somehow, you know, provide that for him. So change the context and, you know, give him a hug or do something which is, you know, more loving, because it's a need, that's one of the interesting things about desire, is that sometimes desire is a manifestation of a deeper need, and maybe I don't know if healthy is the right word here, but a deeper need that needs addressing somehow. And if we're just staying on the surface of, you know, wanting, for example, maybe you want the ice cream, but why do you want ice cream? Might just be because it's a hot day. Who knows why? But it could be because you're feeling lonely or disoriented. And so it's a way of kind of comforting. And the real need is not for ice cream. The real need is somehow address the issue of loneliness. And so part of what we do in mindfulness is... Well, that's one of the reasons why it's so valuable to use mindfulness, to turn the attention away from the thing that we desire. And feel what this feels like to desire. Feel the desiring. Because that gives you an opportunity to look behind the desiring to what might be fueling it. And then really address that. If you don't address that, it's going to be there. You know, you might have the ice cream. The loneliness is still there after the ice cream is worn off. And then you want, you know, something else to fill that same hole. So as children, it can be that way too. So sometimes I try to tune into that with my son and try to then, you know, change the context or offer him that kind of... And sometimes it's a matter of limit setting, you know. And I'm saying I'm going into detail with this because some of you maybe don't care. You're already wiser than I am about this and have your own things to say because you raise kids. But often our mind is like a 2-year-old or a 4-year-old. So everything you learn about raising children is appropriate probably for your own mind. And one of the things is sometimes, you know, it's very clear it's limit setting is necessary. And I was really surprised when I learned how important limit setting was for my son. Because I spent my whole adult life in these Buddhist circles where the whole point was to be kind to people. You know, kind and nice, you know, and considerate for them, you know, whatever. And sometimes that's what you want to do with a kid. You just want to say, no, you can't do that. No way. You know, and then he goes into a temper tantrum. You know, he looks at me like I'm you know, Pol Pot or something, you know. It's like, I feel awful, this look I get, you know. Jesus. You know, like public enemy number one. And, but, you know, I have to hold my ground and say no. And then the thing that amazed me was that 30 seconds later, he's completely relaxed and at ease. Completely. And he needed to have that limit set in order to feel safe and secure and know that the world has some order to it and some, you know. And he's going to fight it. But he really, what he wants, really what he's asking sometimes is a really strong no. And sometimes that's true with the mind. Sometimes the wise thing to do with the mind is to say, no, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm not going to follow that. So those are some things I'm struggling to learn. Yes?
How would you bring motivation into this equation? Uh-huh. You touched upon it.
Yeah. Well, motivation is a neutral word. So, you know, you can be, motivation is kind of a, I think a motivation is a little bit deeper than desire. What's the motivation for that desire? And so the motivation might be fear. Or it might be, you know, feeling empty whole. So that's my vocabulary. I think a motivation is being the deeper roots for the desire. And it can be wholesome, it can be unwholesome. It can be, you know, you can be motivation is to go out and harm someone. Give a jabbing, say jabbing comment. That's the comment that's really going to hurt them, or the motivation can be to be say make that kind word that's really going to help them feel better. Our motivation, I think, because I think of the motivation as being a little more deeper than just the thing that we want. I think that it's a very important element of Buddhist practice is to start learning to pay attention to the motivations of what we want to say. What our desires are, what we, you know. And I, when I was at a Zen student, one of my Zen teachers said, one of the ways of understanding Zen Buddhist practice is, in a nutshell, is it involves a purification of our intention. Looking and understanding our intention, studying it, getting to know it, purifying it, refining it, following it, you know, the track of our motivation. Sometimes there are layers of motivation. So you don't just settle for the, you know, now I understand it because you understand a particular aspect of it, but you go deeper and deeper and deeper. Is that, why did you ask the question?
Well, the question comes up because the motivation is really necessary for achievement of any positive.
Right.
You've got to be motivated to learn Zen Buddhism.
Right.
So that's a positive motivation.
Right.
I wouldn't call that necessarily a desire.
I see, yeah.
Motivation is a deep driving force.
Right. But it can be completely neurotic and completely beautiful. There's a word, you know, there's an idea of ambition. One of the interesting questions that's often asked is people ask about, usually about anger, but sometimes about ambition, for example. What's wrong with that? It gets me out of bed, it gets me to do things and accomplish things. As if accomplishing things is the, you know, the definition of a successful life. And it's quite wonderful, and we can be very happy sometimes to accomplish things. But at least the suggestion in Buddhism is that the deep wellsprings of joy in life can come, are unconditioned, don't require the fulfillment of certain conditions. They're inherent in who we are. It's like it's kind of like our essence is already joyful and happy, at peace, kind of like that. And so what we do is we learn how to touch and recognize the inherent sense of well-being that's kind of our nature. And that's more important than the feeling of well-being that can come from accomplishments. So one characterization, expression of this is contentment. And contentment, I think, is a very important, beautiful part of being a human being. And then people say, well, content means you'd be kind of an non-entity means like you're not going to have any ambition, you're not going to do anything in life, and you know, you need to be really ambitious in order to accomplish something. I'm so sad when I hear that, because there can be really beautiful motivations arising out of a contented state. And part of why it's so beautiful, one of the beautiful things about it is that when you act from a contented state, when you have a desire from a contented state, you're not trying to fulfill yourself. You're not trying to get happy through the fulfillment of the desire. The desire, you're already content. So you do it maybe quite strongly and intently, but your happiness is not at stake with it. So it's possible then to do it maybe without expectation, without demand, without even disappointment in some deep way, because your happiness is not rooted and dependent on that accomplishment. Yes?
Just pursuing your things with your own son, I've just spent several days with my grandsons that are approximately the same age. And I find another way that they operate that is similar to the way my mind operates. That is, if they desire one gummy worm, we had them at Lake Tahoe, and I brought a bag of gummy worms, which they seem to love. The first time they wanted one gummy worm, but the second time they wanted two gummy worms. And I think, left alone, we would have gotten up to a bag a time. And I think that's the way the mind often works, too, that if you don't keep the desire under control at the beginning, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
It can be, yeah. Though I've seen that in my son also, and sometimes I think what's going on is he's testing me.
To see how many gummy worms you'll get.
What can I get away with here?
Yeah. And I watched myself wanting to be loved and giving them two gummy worms. Why then stop the three enough already? But yeah, you want to be the good gummy.
Isn't it a great system that they had desires and their desires met your desires? And you know, sometimes it's just the whole, we have this whole, you know, way, the world is a huge, you know, huge, you know, interaction of desires. You know, our desire, this desire is bumping into that person's desires, or, you know, it's really amazing. And so, you know, this expression, you know, love makes the world go round. I think it's a mis, they're not quite right. I think it's desire that makes the world go round. That's the fuel. And often we confuse love with desire. Well, that's an interesting one. The confusion of the love and desire. And that's one of the sad costs of desire, is that when we have those two entangled, we lose sight of really the beauty of love. Love in and of itself doesn't require anything. And often we yoke it, tie it up with our desires. And it's, you know, it's kind of, sometimes it's quite sad because we lose touch with what's most beautiful.
I have one which might be similar to the motivation ambition. But I'm wondering if you could speak to, like, if one has a desire to live a certain lifestyle or a way that's more compatible with, you know, their own nature, but that's hard to bring that about, and so it turns into that grasping. Does that make sense?
Let me see if I can. So you're saying, what if someone has a desire for a more healthy way of living?
Yeah, like maybe just living somewhere else or doing something else for living.
Well, see, a lot of healthy desires can become unhealthy. Right. It really depends, sometimes it doesn't depend on the desire itself. It depends on the way the desire is held. So the example I use when I teach a children's program is, I try to teach kids about desire, right? And so I say that if you have this beautiful bell and you grasp it really hard, you don't have a nice sound. But if you hold it lightly, you have a nice sound. So it's that way. So even really beautiful desires and appropriate desires, maybe it's very appropriate to choose a new life, a new direction, whatever. And but then if we're grasping onto it, or if we're using it also to try to fulfill other needs that are not so healthy, then it can get to headache pretty quickly. Yes?
I have another question about what Heather was just talking about, because I quit my job and I thought, well, I didn't want to do that anymore. Then I started going to school and then I saw all these different things I wanted to do, and then I ended up in a state of confusion. And I just quit going to school. I couldn't figure out what I was there for anymore. And it got really weird. And I said, I need clarity. I don't know how to get clarity around the situation.
I did that once kind of in college, was I quit. I didn't want anything enough. I wanted a lot of different things, but nothing really strongly enough. I thought, if I'm going to pursue a college degree, I should be really strong kind of wish, and really feel right. So I left for 2 years, and it took me 2 years to kind of sort through that, and since something kind of floated to the top. Meditation can help. There's meditation, anything that helps the mind become quiet or still, so they're not being running around in circles with its confusion, can sometimes help give clarity to those kinds of questions. Sometimes talking with friends and just kind of bouncing off friends for a while and having them, if you have a friend who is able to ask really good questions of you, and you just kind of probably probe and think about it in fresh ways, sometimes can help. And sometimes asking the question of the deeper motivation. You know, sometimes it might be interesting to start with a question: what is the deepest intention you have for your life? What's the deepest thing that you want for your life? When you get to your deathbed, and you look back over your lifetime, what would you like to remember that your life was about? Was it about, you know, going to Safeway and, you know, buying a lot of good things, you know, or, you know, all these things that we kind of, all small, you know, getting oil changed in your car, and, you know, it's all these things we can kind of get busy with in normal life and consumed with. But that's, that's not what our life should be about. What is your deepest motivation, deepest intention? And sometimes that kind of reflection, sometimes with a friend who can help you kind of keep focused on it, can sometimes illuminate. Then from there, you can come out of that, say, oh, well, in that case, this is what I want to do.
Well, the thing about it is, teaching doesn't pay any money. I can't afford a home, but the rents are mortgages, and I have to do something because I can't live. I don't want to live like I'm living anymore. And I love children, and they're all great, but I want to do it. I want to take vacations. I want to travel. I can't. But that keeps calling me. I can't work with you.
I understand. This is part of this. This is part of this. This is a huge suffering. Yeah, I understand that.
Sometimes I feel it's greed that's driving me.
Could be.
But then on the other hand, I think I deserve those things. Nice things.
It's possible. But, if you imagine yourself on your deathbed and you think over what your life was about, is it, I had those really good things? You know, when I was younger, I thought I deserved those things. I was really good. I don't know what kind of things you want, but some of the things that I want, I don't want to be thinking about them on my deathbed. You know, it's not that important. But it might be that, when you get to your deathbed, you might want to think, I was a really good teacher, and I really made a big difference in some children's lives, and I'm so happy for that. And otherwise I struggled, and sometimes, I had to sacrifice a lot because of it. But I have this deep satisfaction in my soul where I knew that I was following what I really loved and I really made a difference in some people's lives. Sometimes that kind of, trying to put the whole issue in a different context sometimes can kind of change how you understand it. But, there's a lot of issues involved in your question. And you're raising children and you like them to be raised in a certain lifestyle that, that's not deprived, and so then the balance between, following your passion and your interest and your passion and interest in providing a healthy life for your children, it's a very painful to have those two, stuck between those two different things. And my tendency is to want to encourage people to follow their deepest motivations and interest at the cost, and trusting that somehow things will work out. But, it's what you're talking about is painful.
I want to ask a question about when I am with a person, I've had a friend for many years, and I can see it in someone else better than myself, I'm saying, right?
I'm sorry, when you're with someone you haven't seen for a long time?
I was going to say, I have a friend I've had for a very long time, I can project myself in someone else and sometimes see in another person more clearly what is really me also, right? That's very common. Well, I feel, seeing a bottomless well of desire, a bottomless well of a person who has a beautiful home, who has, you know, this, who has that, who's so loved, who has so many friends, is so safe, and yet never has enough love, never, just in.
Yeah.
It's been very, very painful for me, and I found a pattern where usually I stay in bed all the next day. I don't think exactly about being drained, but I wonder what I'm seeing that is so powerful to. I see it and I understand what is, you know, happening. But seeing it in someone else is almost more like knocks me off my feet, makes me more depressed than seeing it myself. I don't understand it. It's just an incredibly powerful mirror. Or
fascinating. Can you hear that? So what you said is that when she sees, she has a friend, she sees herself in her friend. Common phenomenon, sometimes we project ourselves onto others. And she sees in her friend a bottomless well of desire. And basically has a successful life and has a lot of wonderful things, but always wants more and more and more. And she sees this tendency in herself, but when she sees, and it's sometimes exhausting, but when she sees it in her friend, it has a bigger impact on her. And the next day, sometimes she gets depressed and really, you know, really disturbs her in a deep way. And sometimes you have to kind of just go to bed for the day, right? Yeah. And there's a term in Buddhism for this. The term in Buddhism for this kind of phenomenon is called hungry ghosts. You know about hungry ghosts? You know, hungry ghosts are beings who have really, 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 really big. That's a kind of a 4-year-old language. stomachs, and they have throats that are very, very thin. So they can never get enough food down their throats to fill their stomachs. So they're always hungry and want more and more and more. And some people are driven like that. Some people are hungry ghosts. Usually, it comes from some very deep need or pain within a person. And what we do in practice is we turn the attention back to what it feels like to be a hungry ghost. And at some point, you'll realize the depth of the suffering, of the pain, or the fear, the emptiness, the feeling of unworthiness, or the feeling of lack or insecurity, or some very deep sense of emptiness, perhaps. And then and many people will recoil from that. And if it's very strong, people sometimes get even nauseous from really facing the depths of their own suffering within themselves. And it can be, you know, really exhausting to kind of really touch it and see it. And people will recoil. And there's numbers of strategies that Buddhists will offer in that kind of situation. But one of the ways, the most direct way, through mindfulness, is to go and sit yourself right down in the middle of the heart of the suffering, the heart of that emptiness or feeling of non-existence or fear, or whatever it might be, and sit there and just, as long as it takes, sit there and be very open, very allowing, very attentive, and see how it evolves. And sooner or later, it'll change. What you're raising is a very, very important issue, and I feel a little bit bad even giving you one simple kind of suggestion. It really needs, you know, someone to really sit down with you and really explore it. And either a Buddhist teacher sometimes can sit with you and talk, or perhaps a lot of people do it through therapy, where you can kind of go back over several weeks and really look at this from different angles and have someone ask hopefully really good questions. But it's really important. And what the mindfulness practice can offer is the skill and the ability and maybe the context for learning how to put yourself right down in the heart of what's really going on. It's interesting that the word wanting in English has a kind of double meaning. You can want things, But you can also, we also say in English that the soup is wanting salt, and it means it lacks salt. And sometimes desire comes from a sense of lack, something, a sense of emptiness inside. And what we do in mindfulness is we bring our attention in that place of wanting and lack. So, may you all study your desire, become experts in understanding it well, and may each of you understand what's on the other side of your desire, the peace and the well-being, the tremendous possibility of joy, and the feeling of gratitude, which is really, again, one of the beautiful aspects of human life, is deep gratitude that is often blocked by our desires. So may each of you feel the deep joy, contentment, and gratitude that's possible. Thank you.